Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, technology whiz Chris Sogoyan discusses the government's secret new techniques for spying on you. I hope you'll stay tuned. After all, they are... Chris Sogoyan is a technology expert and a civil liberties champion with the ACLU. He spoke in Seattle recently on the new technologies that keep your private communication private, and on the government's counterattack with other new technologies for spying on everything you do or say. And it's not just the FBI and the NSA who are eavesdropping. More and more, it's your local police force, too. So, if terms like stingrays and the hacking team are new to you, better listen up. Here is Chris Sogoyan.
So, I'm going to give you a bit of a history lesson in an attempt to tell you a story about how surveillance has evolved and how law enforcement and intelligence agencies are addressing and coping with changes in technology. For more than 100 years, the telephone companies have provided assistance to law enforcement agents who wanted to monitor the telephone calls of targets in criminal investigations. For 100 years, these companies have provided this assistance. In many cases, there have been dedicated teams of employees at the companies. Today, hundreds of employees at each company are there responding 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to requests from federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies. Really, for a telephone company at this point, surveillance is part of the business. It's not a business they intended to go into, but it's a business they are now in, whether they like it or not. And so for 100 years, law enforcement agencies have known that they could turn to these trusted parties, these partners, the AT&Ts and Verizons of the world, who would give them what they want, and then eventually would even build surveillance features into the very core parts of their network. Our phones today are designed first and foremost to be surveilled. They're designed to deliver calls and text messages as almost an afterthought, but the first feature is the surveillance feature. And so what I want to talk to you about today is sort of how governments have responded to changes in technology, and in particular, how they've responded to first the possibility that people would protect their communications, and then ultimately the availability and use of technologies that would protect people's communications. This is Louis Free. Louis Free was the director of the FBI in the 1990s, and Free was really the first FBI official and first US government official to raise the threat of encryption technology to the public debate. The language that Free used was really a big deal at the time. This is in the mid-1990s, when technology that would allow regular people to protect their communications from surveillance was controlled by law. It was controlled as arms technology, and thus not available for export outside the United States. I'm going to read you some of his quotes. "Uncrackable encryption will allow drug lords, spies, terrorists, and even violent gangs to communicate about their crimes and their conspiracies with impunity." This is this doomsday scenario that Free was describing of a world in which encryption was available to the masses. He added, "The only acceptable answer is socially responsible encryption that permits timely law enforcement and national security access and decryption pursuant to a court order." What Free was talking about was something that technologists and those of us in this space call key escrow. The idea was that a copy of your encryption key, a copy of your encryption password, would be stored by some third party, and if you did something bad or the government decided to take an interest in you, they could go to that third party and get the key and then decipher all your communications. This was the socially responsible cryptography that Free was calling for in 1996. And this is actually the chip that implemented this technology. It was called the Clipper chip, and the idea was that there would be one of these chips in every telephone in the country, and all of our communications would be encrypted, which was a good thing, but the encryption could be broken by the government whenever they needed to, in case that someone did something bad. So the Clipper was not a success in the market. It turned out that people didn't want this technology, particularly once researchers showed that the encryption was broken and couldn't just be broken by the government, but could be broken by anyone else. And so towards the end of the 1990s, this system of controls over technology came down. The wall fell down, and suddenly people could export this encryption technology. Suddenly anyone in the world could download free software or buy commercial software that could protect their emails, that could protect their messages, and allow them to communicate in a way that governments could not read or decipher their communications. But PGP, which is one of those tools, it was never a problem for the FBI. It was never a problem for law enforcement. And the reason was is that the encryption tools that were available looked something like this. And in fact, they haven't really changed in their design since then. It turns out that the encryption tools that were available in the 1990s, the encryption tools that the government said everyone could use, were so difficult to use correctly that no one ever used them. So that brings us to where we are now. Where encryption technology not only is becoming easier to use, but it is now increasingly being built into the products that we all use. So this is the current FBI director, Jim Comey. This is him speaking at a cryptography event in Washington, D.C. Just a few months ago, you can see Comey Crypto, which was the hashtag behind his head. And I'm going to read you a quote of his. "Encryption threatens to lead all of us to a very dark place. Sophisticated criminals will come to count on these means of evading detection. It's the equivalent of a closet that cannot be opened, a safe that cannot be cracked." So the rhetoric really hasn't changed in 20 years. The rhetoric is the same. They're still predicting doomsday scenarios, but what's changed is that people are actually using encryption now. So, of course, this is Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple. Apple has been very bold in its marketing in the last year or two. This is from Apple's privacy section of their website. "Your iMessages and FaceTime calls are your business, not ours. Your communications are protected by end-to-end encryption across all your devices when you use iMessage and FaceTime. And we wouldn't be able to comply with a wiretap order even if we wanted to." So what this means is that right now, if you have an iPhone or an iPad, and you send text messages or you make a video or audio call with their products to someone else who also has an iPad or an iPhone, those messages are encrypted. And they're encrypted in such a way that if you listen to what Apple says and you believe what Apple says, which I think reasonable people can ask questions about, they're not able to monitor, and thus the government is not able to easily monitor. Now that's a really big change. That's a sea change from where we were just a few years ago, when if you were making a call with your AT&T or Verizon phone, those companies could and would hand over your telephone communications. They could and would record copies of your text messages and hand them over to government agents at a later date. What's fascinating about what Apple has done isn't that they have made encryption available to users, but that they have turned it on by default. And so even if you don't think about it, you're now using and gaining the protections of this encryption technology. Apple isn't the only player. I don't know how many of you in this room use WhatsApp, but this is an extremely popular service, particularly in the global south and many, many non-US countries. It is basically the de facto text messaging service. And WhatsApp now also uses extremely strong encryption technology, some of the best that's out there. This is the founder of WhatsApp, Jan Koum, saying, quote, "I grew up in a society where everything you did was eavesdropped on, recorded, snitched on. Nobody should have the right to eavesdrop or you become a totalitarian state, the kind of state I escaped as a kid to come to this country." Pretty bold statement from a tech company CEO. And again, this is a company whose product is used by hundreds of millions of people. Now, if you don't trust Apple, and you don't trust WhatsApp, which is now owned by Facebook, and you have the ability to convince your friends and loved ones and colleagues to download other software, there's a tool that I really like that's called Signal. It's available in the App Store, and a version of it is also available for Android phones. And using this app, you can make free encrypted telephone calls and send encrypted text messages. Doesn't cost you any money. And this is made by a team of widely respected researchers. There are no hidden back doors in the service. The problem is your friends and loved ones are probably not using it already, so you have to sort of convince them to download this, whereas with iMessage or WhatsApp, probably people are already using it. And so it's the availability of services like this. It's the fact that suddenly hundreds of millions of people now have access to encryption technology and are now using encryption technology that is causing an epic freakout in law enforcement and national security circles. So I'm speaking in Seattle, Microsoft, hometown employer, going to get asked, so what's the deal with Microsoft's technology, right? We know that Apple and WhatsApp, which is Facebook, are doing this. What about Microsoft? So Microsoft bought Skype. I assume everyone in the audience knows that Skype is a Microsoft service. According to an article that Glenn Greenwald published in 2013, Microsoft has modified their services to make them more amenable to wiretapping by the U.S. government. Quote, Skype was served with a directive to comply by the Attorney General, and after they received that order, they made modifications to the service that allowed the NSA to be able to monitor people's Skype text messages and also Skype audio and video calls. This is Brad Smith, who is Microsoft's general counsel, fairly outspoken guy, has criticized the actions of the U.S. government in forcing Microsoft to hand over data on its Dublin-based servers, Dublin, Ireland-based servers to the U.S. government. This is him in an interview last year. We assume that all calls, whether over the internet or by fixed line or mobile phone, will offer similar levels of privacy and security. So that's Brad Smith saying that the degree of security that Microsoft intends to deliver to customers is the same that you get from your cell phone, which isn't very much. So, you know, if you're deeply concerned about privacy, if you don't want the state to be able to wiretap your communications, I'm afraid that I can't really recommend Skype, but there are plenty of other tools that you can use that will make surveillance much more difficult. All right, so these tools are on your phone today. How are government agencies going to respond? Right? They're not going to just pack up their luggage and go home. They want to be able to wiretap the communications of interesting individuals, individuals who they believe are doing things that are bad. How will they respond? So in 2012, I started researching the question of hacking by governments. There have been a number of stories showing that governments around the world were buying off-the-shelf hacking software that governments in Ethiopia and Vietnam and other places were buying commercial surveillance technology that they could use to hack into people's computers and take over their webcams and microphones and that kind of thing. And I thought, well, hang on, the FBI has a lot of money. They're probably doing it too, right? So I stumbled on this document that another civil liberties group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, had been able to get from the government through FOIA. And as you can see, most of it's redacted, but there was this one line on the document, this remote operations unit that I saw, and I thought, well, that sounds interesting. And so I started Google stalking the remote operations unit at the FBI to see what I could find out, and I looked at the LinkedIn pages of contractors who'd worked there. I found that the unit chief of the ROU in his university fraternity alumni magazine described what he did at his day job. And so I was eventually able to take all this information and give it to the Wall Street Journal, and they were able to confirm that the FBI has a dedicated team of agents in Quantico, Virginia, and all they do every day is hack into people's computers. They have the ability to activate microphones and webcams. The most fascinating thing is the light next to your webcam isn't controlled by hardware. So they can turn the camera on without the light also going on. The light is sort of for your benefit, but not if the FBI is in your computer. And so this team has existed, it turns out, in one form or another, since 2002. And it wasn't until last year that the FBI finally started to be at least a little bit open about their use of this technology. They went to this obscure body in Washington, D.C., a body run by the courts, and they said, we have this problem that right now we need to go to a judge in the district where the crime is happening to get a court order, and if we don't know where the bad guy is, we don't know which judge to go to. So we want permission to get a judge in any part of the country to authorize hacking in any other part of the country. So that was our opportunity, the first time ever for anyone in the civil liberties community to say, hang on a second, maybe we should have a conversation about hacking before we give the FBI these powers. So the problem is they have this surveillance software. They need to get it onto your computer somehow. They have to trick you into downloading it or hack into your browser or something. And so it turns out that trickery is a pretty common method that they use. That was the big news last November. It's odd for me to come here to Seattle where this, you know, in the region where this thing actually happened. And again, this wasn't like the biggest terrorism threat in the world. This was a student calling it a bomb threat because he or she didn't want to take their exam on time. This is a really powerful surveillance tool being used in that case. So the FBI has a lot of money, and when agencies have lots of money, they buy really powerful tools. But not all agencies have the same resources and the same tools. And so what we find is that other law enforcement agencies that have the same needs but don't have the same budgets have to get lesser quality, cut-price tools. And luckily, there is a thriving industry of commercial surveillance companies who are quite happy to sell sophisticated surveillance technology to law enforcement agencies around the world. So one of these companies is called Hacking Team. Their product is called DaVinci. This is from some of their marketing materials. Defeat encryption, total control over your targets, thousands of encrypted communications per day, get them. I mean, the marketing is not shy. They say that they can get encrypted voice, location, web browsing, the works. So I've been tracking this company for several years. Their software has shown up on the computers of activists and reporters in Morocco, in Ethiopia, in Vietnam, I mean, in use by some governments that really have no respect for human rights. This company doesn't care about who they sell to. And so I've seen that for the last few years, they've been coming to Washington, D.C., and have been speaking at and exhibiting at this surveillance industry trade show where law enforcement agencies show up and see like what the cool tools are that year. And I actually went to this conference. I snuck in 2012, and I put on a suit. And I don't know how many of you have been to Washington, D.C., but the uniform in Washington, D.C. is ugly, ill-fitting suits. And so I bought this like cheap suit from the thrift store, and I put it on, and I went to the conference, and I snuck in, and I secretly recorded what I saw. And this company was there, and they were giving out their flyers and the mints and the fridge magnets. And so I learned about them there. It turns out they don't just go to that conference. They actually go to the Association of Law Enforcement Intelligence Units annual conference. This is larger police departments have dedicated teams that just do surveillance. And this is the annual U.S. conference for these law enforcement agencies' surveillance teams. So I've been hunting down Hacking Team for a while, because I'm convinced that they've sold their stuff in the United States. They have an office in Washington, D.C., and I think it's only a matter of time before their stuff is used by state and local agencies. So the problem with this technology, and not just the hacking software, but in fact many kinds of surveillance technology, is that it's expensive. I mean, not like millions and millions of dollars, but like $200,000, $300,000. That's too much money for a local law enforcement agency. They have stretched budgets, particularly in these current economic times. They don't have the money for these cool toys, or cool tools, rather. And so luckily, there are nice bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. who are happy to give grant money to local law enforcement agencies. And so where you've seen surveillance technologies spreading into your community, here in Washington State, in Tacoma, where they purchased Stingray technology, it was with grants from DHS. So you guys got a mesh network web camera thing here in Seattle, money from Washington, D.C. If there have been surveillance cameras in your streets, money from Washington, D.C. Where it's been drones or armored personnel carriers, money from Washington, D.C. Bearcats, the armored personnel carriers that I think many people saw in the wake of Ferguson, money from DHS, money from DOJ, and surplus from DOD. Drones making their way into small town communities, money from Washington, D.C. And this thing, the tool that I've been hunting for 4 years, the Stingray, this is a tool that allows law enforcement agents to track and identify every cell phone in an area, money from Washington, D.C. So what's fascinating about the Stingray, and I guess similarly to the hacking stuff and the drones and these other things, these were tools that were designed for the military and for the intelligence community. And the problem is that the Raytheons and the Booz Allens and the Boeings that sell this technology, they can only sell so much to the military. Eventually, they've saturated that market. And so they're looking for additional markets, and while law enforcement is a happy market, these tools make law enforcement's job easier. So the tools sell themselves. The only question is, well, how do we pay for them? And that's where Washington, D.C. comes in. They write blank checks to pay for the gear. So, you know, I think reasonable people can have a debate about whether these technologies are appropriate in Iraq or Afghanistan or Yemen, and I'm sure that my views maybe aren't in line with everyone's, but I think many of us should be able to agree that technologies that are designed for use in a hostile war zone may not necessarily be appropriate for Main Street back here in the United States. And the Stingray is an example of this. This is a technology that sends signals into people's living rooms. This is not a surgical technology that tracks one phone. This is a technology that sends signals into every house in a neighborhood, identifies every phone that's nearby, creates a list of every phone that's nearby, and then provides that to the agent that's using the device. This is a technology that was built for the intelligence services. Just this week, the Wall Street Journal had a story talking about the relationship between the CIA and the marshals. The marshals put these things on airplanes and fly them over cities, and it described the relationship between the CIA technology unit and the marshals technology unit as a marriage. That's how close they are. Presumably a happy marriage, not an unhappy one. But this is a technology that is now trickling down to state and local law enforcement agencies around the country, and we know that they're in use here in Washington State. These are technologies that have been put into use in your community without any debate. Because the money came from Washington, they didn't have to go to the city council and have a thorough debate about how these technologies were going to be used. They didn't have to explain how they would work. They wouldn't have to explain the collateral damage or the fact that they would collect information about innocent people who've done nothing wrong. They go to the city council and they say, hey, we got this grant from FEMA or from DOJ. Can we accept the money? You know, this will help law enforcement, this will keep us safe. And of course, the city councils always say yes, because who's going to turn down free money, free training, free tools? So these tools are put into our communities without any oversight from our city councils, from our state legislative bodies, or even in Congress. There have been no hearings at the federal level, and there have only been hearings on stingrays in the last year in Michigan and Texas and here in Washington State. These are technologies that are put into use in communities without any debate, and it's not like that's an oversight, that's the purpose. The argument that law enforcement agents use is that they have to put this technology into use secretly, because if they told the public how it worked, it would tip off the bad guys. We see these quotes time and time again from local police chiefs saying, look, you know, we're using this in the right way, we're using it in an appropriate way, but we can't tell you anything more, you have to trust us. Because if we told people how it worked, the bad guys would figure out how to avoid it. Right? And that's this conflict in the area of surveillance. They don't want to tell us how it works because someone in this room is going to commit a crime, so the rest of us have to be kept in the dark so that one person doesn't know how it works. So, and then in addition to not having any debate, means we also don't have any oversight. Legislative bodies don't know, and more importantly, the courts don't know. So here in Washington State, the courts have been kept in the dark. Around the country, courts have been kept in the dark. To the extent that law enforcement agencies get court orders for this, the applications for the court orders don't say what they're planning on doing. But because of this transparency that's coming from local media, because of organizations like the ACLU that have been forcing this stuff into the sunlight, it's starting to change. And so in Tacoma, we're now seeing that judges have instituted a new protocol. They now demand that the police change the way they get permission for this technology. Judges demand information from the police. And all it took was a few front page stories. So, as I said, we've now had hearings in, I think, three or four states about stingrays. There are several states where legislation has been introduced. In Virginia, where I live, there's a bill sitting on the governor's desk that would require a warrant for stingrays. I know here in Washington, your state house has passed a bill, and there'll be a hearing tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. for the Senate to look at that legislation, and then hopefully it will reach the governor's desk. In Utah, they require a warrant for all cell tracking. So bit by bit, we're getting some oversight over these invasive cell phone tracking technologies. But what we're not getting just yet is similar oversight and action from legislative bodies about hacking technology. I think one of the reasons for that is that right now we only know that federal agencies are using it. We haven't caught any state or local law enforcement agencies using it. I'm sure they're using it, right? Hacking team has an office in Maryland. They're sending their salespeople out. They're buying coffee at conferences. I'm sure that someone's bought this stuff. But until we catch them red-handed, until we get a front-page story in a small-town paper, we're not going to get reform. But this technology is so invasive. The idea that the police can turn on your webcam and your microphone without your knowledge and listen to what's happening in your bedroom or in your office or, you know, in your psychiatrist's office, this is terrifying, the capability, and there's been absolutely no oversight. And so we need to get oversight over this technology, over the use of these tools. We need to make sure that our state legislative bodies and ultimately that Congress takes a close look at this. But it all starts here in small communities and even big cities like Seattle. It all starts with your local ACLU affiliate. It all starts with your local press who are hounding police and getting questions from judges and finding out what your law enforcement agencies are doing. Thank you for your time.
Chris Segoyan with Words for Our Time, speaking in Seattle on March 11, 2016. Our thanks to Seattle's own Mike McCormick for the original audio recording, which I have condensed just a tad. And thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust saying, keep the Aspidistra flying, write if you get work. Good night, Chet. Good night, David. Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. And illegitimi non carborundum, one and all. Peace.